Hello, welcome to Object Matters, the podcast of the Chow Chak Wing Museum. My name's Craig Barker, and I'm the Head of Public Engagement at the Chow Chak Wing Museum at the University of Sydney. This podcast explores the relationship between our guest and a museum object or a series of objects from the collection. And for this particular episode, I'm really, really excited to be joined by an old friend and an old friend of the Chow Chak Wing Museum, Professor Alistair Blanchard. Alistair is a classicist and ancient historian. He is the Paul Eliadis Chair of Classics and Ancient History at the University of Queensland, and he, as I said, has been a long-term supporter of the Nicholson Collection of the Museum. Welcome, Alistair. Thank you very much for joining us on Object Matters.
Thank you, Craig. Delighted to be back here.
Now, before we talk about objects, I'd like to talk a little bit about your career and a little bit about your own research interests. Could you begin by talking about your background and your research interests and how you got to be an ancient historian?
Right, yes. Well, look, I started off, in fact, as an arts law student many years ago at the University of Queensland and discovered that while I quite enjoyed law, what I really enjoyed was, in fact, studying the ancient world and, in particular, the Greeks. And it was that passion for the Greeks that I decided to pursue as a career and went on to study overseas and then originally training as a historian of the ancient Greeks, a social and cultural historian of the ancient Greeks. But then later on, my interests became very much involved in the legacy of the Greeks. So how the Greeks impacted on all subsequent cultures after them, both the Romans, but also into the Renaissance, 17th, 18th, 19th, 20th, 20th, 21st centuries.
Yes,
so
yes.
So that was really became my real interest at the moment, which is the kind of the legacy of Hellenism and what I guess you might call the sort of reception of the ancient world.
I was just going to say that broader concept of reception studies, which has become a really popular aspect of classics over the past two or three decades as well, hasn't
it? Yes, it's probably one of the biggest growth areas in the discipline. And certainly when I first started doing it, it was possible to read everything on the topic of reception. That's no longer the case. I mean, you know, at best, you can kind of try and keep abreast of what's happening in your own area. But but it's burgeoning in all sorts of different kinds of ways. It's really exciting.
It actually is. It's really interesting seeing some of the papers that are coming out, some of the ideas that are coming out. I'll talk to you about Hercules or Heracles in particular in a moment, but you have written a lot about film in particular, but I know that in more recent years you've been branching out. Look, I know that you've been looking at the legacy of the Greek world in 18th and 19th century painting and literature and other aspects as well too. What's your kind of current interest?
Yeah, so my current interest is, in fact, is in the 18th century. So you're right, I have done a little very modern stuff. I wrote some stuff about film and then some stuff about kind of eroticism and sexuality in the 19th century. But it's the 18th century that's currently my great interest. It's that moment when Western Europe rediscovers Greece, and we start to see travellers, particularly from Britain and France, visiting Greece for the very first time, and the tremendous impact that had on them, and how it changed their perceptions of what is the beautiful, how it changed their perceptions of what the ancient Greeks were, in fact, their own sense of kind of legacy and past. So it's a tremendous kind of moment in terms of the formation of kind of the European consciousness. And so it's really something that really interests me and fascinates me.
Also, I mean, that broader neoclassical movement, the impact that's had on colonialism, including in a country like Australia, but in the way that a lot of those European colonial powers were seeing themselves as the inheritors of the Greek and Roman legacy. And so it's not just through cultural spread, but also an ideological one as well.
This desire to kind of legitimate yourself by going back to antiquity and seeing, creating in some sense a kind of past, past for yourself. But there's also, in a sense, a kind of something quite sort of noble about it as well, which is that the turn to the Greeks was also about a desire to escape the prison of the nation state.
Right.
So that you embraced kind of Greek architecture because it wasn't bound by any national tradition. It wasn't Russian or French or German or English. But in fact, here was a kind of koine, something that kind of unified all the sort of Enlightenment powers. And so there's an idea of kind of a cosmopolitanism that also flows through it as well.
Interesting. I've never thought about it from that perspective, but you're right, isn't it? The fact that you can see a neoclassical building in Jamaica and a neoclassical building in Poland, and they're coming out of that same cultural tradition. That's an interesting perspective.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And I think, you know, that sort of desire to kind of, you know, we used to talk about a republic of letters, the idea that, you know, this was a place that kind of escaped kind of national boundaries. And I think that classicism functions in much the same way. Now, it's still a very European, Eurocentric version of what is, you know, a republic, and so not everyone's going to get in. But I think this idea, certainly, of trying to escape kind of the nation state, I think, is something that's important to recognise.
Of course, one of the reasons you're in Sydney is that last night you helped us launch a new exhibition called Hercules, Myth and Legacy. I know that you've written a lot about Hercules, and in particular from that reception studies perspective, but could you just talk a little bit about your interest in him and how we perceive him as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So I fell into studying and writing on Hercules entirely by accident. So I was approached by a commercial publisher who said, look, we'd love a book on Alexander the Great. And to be honest, I couldn't think of anything worse than writing on Alexander the Great. So I had to think of a figure who I could sell them, who was as popular, as much brand recognition, name recognition. As Alexander the Great. And I just thought, well, maybe Hercules might be a figure. And anyway, so
they said yes.
They said yes. And then, the next thing I knew, I had an advance, which meant I had to write a book. So I did. And it was really a great opportunity to kind of reflect on a figure who is ubiquitous in the ancient world, right? Yep. He's everywhere.
Yes. Yeah.
And, you know, there are stories about him from every corner of the Mediterranean. And so it was nice to kind of think about this figure and think about, you know, how those stories get put together, what do those stories mean for the various kinds of communities. But then also to think about the afterlife of those stories. You know, there are thousands of stories of Hercules. Why do some matter more than others?
Yep.
And why have we really taken to our heart some of those stories and kind of forgotten the others?
Yep.
So that was some of my interest in Hercules.
Yeah. No, it's been interesting. I mean, the book you referred to is one thing that I personally keep on dipping into time and time again, but yeah, it's just extraordinary. And of course, we, you know, in terms of reception studies, we still live with Hercules all the time. All those sword and sandal films that we both love.
You yes, know, there's critics the... don't.
No. I just don't understand why. But he pops up in Hollywood sort of every decade or so.
That's right. Yes, yeah. In fact, that we just had a couple of Hercules films come up. There was the kind of The Rock, and then there was the even worse one. Oh gosh, what's his name?
I did know. That one from my mind.
It was so terrible. The actor's quite pretty, but I can't remember what his name is. Come to me in a second. Lutz.
That's right. Yes.
Keelan Lutz.
Yes.
Terrible film. Terrible film.
Yes. Apologies if he happens to listen to this.
He could only work with the material he was given.
That's true. Even Laurence Olivier would have struggled with that script. Now, there's often a very, very incorrect assumption that classics and ancient history is an academic discipline which is text-based only. You and many of your colleagues in the field have disproved this by the work with material culture, but how do you think that working with material culture, including museum collections, help us understand the world of ancient Greece and Rome? And, you know, do you see it as the old idea of the illustrations are the handmaids to history, archaeology is the handmaid to history, or do you see that it's...
Yes, provides the footnotes. I think, you know, there are a number of reasons why you'd want to kind of look at some material cultural objects. But I think, you know, I think the first thing just to recognise is that, you know, literature is an elite product, right? It's designed, written by an elite, circulates amongst the elite. And given kind of literacy levels, you know, it's only ever going to give you really a kind of insight into a very small segment of society. Now, there are, of course, certain texts which we know are extraordinarily popular. So, you know, Homer, for example, would be a really clear case of a text like that. But on the whole, the kind of literary texts that we look at are really a kind of elite product. Yeah. So if you want to get beyond that elite, you're going to have to look somewhere else. And that's going to be the objects of day-to-day life that we find in the museums.
Yeah. Not to mention, of course, the limitations in terms of what has actually survived in terms of the canon of
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, I mean, I think everyone's, you know, got their... their favourite bit that never made
hasn't
it
survived.
Hasn't survived it. But yes, yeah. I mean, I think you know, we've got a very partial a partial selection. I suppose the other thing just to observe is really that the ancient world was a very visual world as well. That is, that the Greeks and Romans did their thinking as much through images as they do through text.
Yes.
And I'm always struck whenever I look at a kind of vase painting with a mythological scene and think, look, there's as much kind of philosophy and theology going on in that image as you'd find in a text of Plato.
Yeah.
So they're clever with images. They're playful with images. Yeah. And I think that that also needs to be recognised as well. There's a lot of thinking going on visually.
Yeah. I mean, I'm always struck too by the idea of just how powerful the images would have been for an audience in contemporary Greece, in that we, of course, live in a visual society in the 21st century, but we're bombarded by visual images, that they've lost their meaning to some degree. Whereas actually in a society where images are rarer, for want of a better word, they have greater power.
I think that's right. I think that's absolutely right. I mean, in pre-industrial societies, right, the objects like, these handmade objects, whether they're sculpture, whether they're painted vases, are obviously going to be, valued a lot more. They're obviously going to have greater impact. But I think we also need to realise that actually Athens was a city full of images, right?
I mean,
you go up to the Acropolis and it's kind of, these days, right, it's completely bare space with just a temple there, right?
The colour.
And no colour, right? You would have gone up in the 5th century, it would have been full of statues, dedications, stelae, inscriptions. It would have actually been quite a confronting image. And it's the same for all the great Greek sanctuaries as well. Then you go down to the marketplace, and it's full of statues, dedications, painted stoas. So there's a lot of visual imagery that would have been around there.
John Papadopoulos used to refer to it as the Acropolis Milk Bar when he was lecturing.
Milky white.
Now, you, of course, used to teach at the University of Sydney for some time, and while there, but also, of course, subsequently, you've worked with the Nicholson Collection back in the days when it used to be the Nicholson Museum. How did you first come about working with that collection?
Yes, I remember when I first arrived at the University of Sydney, and I'd heard about the Nicholson collection. I grew up in Brisbane, and word would travel to even to darkest Queensland about the wonders that were available in Sydney. But I'd never seen it as a student. It was only when I came back to Australia to work, and I just remember my very first day being completely blown away by the quality of the material and the breadth of the material as well. I hadn't realised just what an extraordinary range of material and the real strengths that it had in so many different areas.
Yes.
It wasn't a one-hit wonder of a museum. Yes. It was a really solid museum with a fantastic collection across all sorts of times, places, cultures, genres. And that, of course, meant that, it was the place to incorporate for your teaching. Mm. I remember, the thing we always decided in the first year Greek history course was we need to get the students into the museum as soon as possible. Because it's just such a fantastic, wonderful collection.
Yeah. Well, thank you for bringing a generation of students through. So, Alistair, that actually segues very, very nicely into Object Matters, which, of course, is about objects within the collection and how we respond to them and how we relate to them. What item, or I should say items, have you chosen today for us to discuss from the Chow Chak Wing Museum collection?
Well, look, I chose two of actually my favourite objects in the collection. These are a couple of fish plates, South Italian fish plates. I just absolutely love them and thought they'd be fun to discuss.
They are beautiful. Could you describe them to our listeners?
Yes, sure. So what they are a couple of plates, highly decorated with depictions of various types of seafood, primarily fish, on them. They're round, they're on a raised little pedestal foot. They are concave with a little bit of a dip in the middle for presumably some sort of sauce or something.
Yep.
But they would have been used as a serving dish for seafood. They're really, really beautiful.
You can imagine sort of the setting of the table around these and them sort of really being central placed in terms of their decorative elements. You talked about how you love them. Is there, any particular reason you chose all of the objects we have from Greece? Why these two stuck out?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think in particular what I think, you learn a lot of a culture by the food that it eats. And this
is true for all sorts of kind of Greek foodstuffs, you know, cheese, olives, bread, all the kind of staples of the Mediterranean diet. But amongst the Greek foodstuffs, I think one stands out, and that's fish, the absolute love of fish that the Greeks had. And fish was the prized luxury food, even more than today. These days, you know, seafood is always regarded as a bit of a celebratory fish, right? Yes. You know, it's the kind of thing you get at Christmas, for example, you know, queue for hours at the Sydney Fish Market to get your pile of prawns. Well, you know, that's nothing compared to the devotion that that the ancient Greeks had for fish. You know, these days, if you love someone, you know, you give them roses and a box of chocolates. In the ancient world, you gave them fish. That was the lover's gift par excellence. We know that a number of the well-known courtesans in antiquity go by, as a sort of stage name, use fish names. So we have, you know, Miss Mullet, you know, and or Miss, you know, Miss Smelt, you know. There were the two kind of really glamorous young women, highly desirable women in Athens, were known as the Anchovy Sisters. You know, this is a highly prized commodity. Yeah. And so it's a beautiful thing, and they're kind of rather lovely.
As works of art, even taking them out of their social history context, they are incredibly vivid representations. And to me, yeah, whenever I see a fish plate, I'm always reminded of the famous seafood mosaic in Pompeii as well, too, which whilst is much, much later than the vases we're looking at. But again, just that extraordinary biological illustrative. You know, it's like one of those 19th century natural history paintings. The details are so extraordinary.
Well, that's it. And you can absolutely identify the very species of fish that decorate the decorate those plates. Well, we know that, in fact, these are plates which must have had very positive associations, because we have a lot of them. And that's another reason why I chose them, is because even if you can't make it into the Chalchaquin Museum, most decent antiquities collections would have a fish plate, a South Italian fish plate.
Certainly a Google image search,
you'll find dozens of them. So they're a well known object, and they survive because they're put in graves, and clearly they mattered to the people whom they're interred with. So again, there are kind of positive associations. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I just love them. I love the fact you can identify the various types of fish. So if you look, for example, on the Campanian example, we have, you know, a striped perch, a bass. What we have is also a really lovely torpedo fish, which is a fantastic fish. So this is an electrical charge producing fish.
Oh, is it?
It's the electric ray is otherwise known. And indeed, the word torpedo comes from the Latin torpore, to be made sluggish or numb. So this is a fish which discharges an electrical charge, which numbs you. And so, in fact, that's where we get the word torpedo from. It's not because, you know, it's something that moves fast. These days we kind of think of torpedo as something that moves fast, but actually it was because they explode.
Yes.
Exploding fish. Or the fish that renders you numb.
It takes out the surrounding
thing. So that's where the word torpedo comes from. That's where we get the torpedo fish. And indeed, in ancient medicine, they were you use, for example, to deal with the pains of childbirth. You know, you'd stick your hand into a basin with a torpedo fish, and you'd soon forget about the pain of childbirth. They also recommend, you know, the shock of a torpedo fish for headaches as well.
Which, really?
Again, you think, you know, presumably it's because your hand's so sore that you've forgotten entirely
about that principle
headache.
Of dropping a hammer on your toe to get rid of the sore thumb.
Exactly. So it's the same thing. So they're a kind of rather, but they're also terribly good eating. You know, they're an ugly fish, and there's this kind of rule of fishing that, you know, the uglier the fish, the better the taste. And so that the kind of flat torpedo fish is a really wonderful one. And again, likewise, if we look at the other example, what we have here is a couple of striped brim, this very famous two-banded brim, really very common Mediterranean fish, and also a rather lovely horn shell as well, this kind of conch shell.
It's beautifully depicted, actually.
Absolutely lovely. And again, quite good eating. So these days, probably encounter it in like a seafood stew is where we tend to find this kind of mollusks being used. And particularly,
Round in Italy, actually, you can still find a lot of these hornshell mollusks used in local stews as well. So these parts both come from South Italy, from the southern part, from Puglia and Campania?
Yes, right. I mean, I was going to actually ask you to explain to our listeners where Campania is, where Puglia is.
Right, so basically, if you imagine Italy as a boot, so Puglia is the kind of the heel of the boot, and Campania's across to the west. These days, I guess Naples would be the place.
Yeah, the Naples area, and Pompeii and Herculaneum.
Exactly, absolutely. Yeah. So that's the area that is producing these. But this type of dish really originates in Attica in about the 5th century, moves across to southern Italy. The Attic examples tend to be not as highly decorated as the southern Italian ones, and the southern Italian ones are really gorgeous, and also, as I say, they survive in a way that the Attic examples don't, because they're put in tombs.
I mean, some of our listeners who are not as well-versed in ancient history may be wondering, why is it a Greek vase but coming from the south of Italy?
Right, otherwise known as Magna Graecia, Greater Greece, right? So southern Italy settled by Greek colonists very early on and was a home to some of the really great Greek cities. Indeed, arguably, if you want to see, the best Greek temples, you go to, in fact, Sicily. You don't go to Greece. In fact, I always feel sorry for kind of Greece these days, because, of course, both Turkey and Italy have, I think, much better.
Certainly better surviving architecture.
Exactly. Yeah.
So it's interesting. I mean, we don't know the provenance of either, but as you alluded to before, it's almost certain that they've both come from tombs. And again, you talked a bit about that connection as well. I sometimes think that, well, I certainly know from conversations I have with people that they're sometimes surprised as to why would you be buried with these types of pots? Surely they're functional. They're the types of things that are going to be used by your family after you're deceased or so on. But why have they taken on that sort of funerary aspect?
Good question. I mean, sometimes vases are chosen because we think that the imagery itself speaks to the afterlife.
Yeah.
And it may be the case.
The Dionysic scenes.
The Dionysic scenes, absolutely, are often alluded to in that way. Here, probably it's just a desire for having something that mattered to you in life, that was associated with moments of joy, celebration, and who doesn't want to continue that kind of thing in the afterlife as well?
Yes.
So I think that's really what we've got here. I mean, they're lovely objects, but we also need to make sure that we put them in the right register as well. That is to say that these are not. It's not that the family's burying the silver with granny, right? These are functional objects they're expensive, but they're not.
Not elite.
They're certainly not gold or silver, for example. And we know that there would have been gold and silver examples as
and
well.
Of course, they haven't survived.
They
are gold and silver.
That's right, exactly. Whereas the ceramic ones, do.
Now, the question we often get asked by people about the collection more broadly, but in particular about Mediterranean antiquities, of course, is how they got to Sydney. In the case of this, the Campanian vase was actually acquired by the old Friends of the Nicholson Museum back in the mid-1940s. And this was part of a big expansion of the South Italian collection under the then curator, Arthur Dale Trendall, Professor Trendall, who, of course, was the great 20th century scholar of pottery of this particular region. Besides its obvious aesthetic appeal, why do you think Trendall would have been interested in a vase like this?
Well, look, you've got to have one, right? I mean,
yeah,
they're so kind of important for understanding kind of southern Italian pottery, and they're just a really wonderful example. And Trendall always had a good eye for a beautiful vase, and the advice he gave to the National Gallery of Victoria in terms of the vases that they acquired, particularly their kind of white ground Lekythoi, are astonishing. Right? Some of the most beautiful vases you will see. And this as fish plates go, this one's a really good one. One of the things I love about it is it's not only got the fish, but it's got these very strange, unidentifiable sea creatures on them as well. In fact, I noted that they're describing the catalogue as four smaller sea creatures, because let's face it, who can work out what the hell they are?
So, well, I've always read that one as a shrimp.
Look, it is a shrimp, but it's no shrimp that you've ever seen, right?
No, you've got that on your Barbie.
But they're rather nice. I mean, this one here looks like a tiny little shark. The other ones are probably sort of stylized mollusks or those kind of things. But it's a kind of wonderful sort of testament to the kind of fecundity of the sea, right? This is a plate that's kind of groaning with seafood. And in fact, that may be part of the conceit of the plate, right? Which is that if you've got a plate that's highly decorated with seafood, you can get away with just putting a few bits of fish on the plate, and it looks like you've actually sitting down to a feast. So
every time I see them, to me, it's also a symbol of how overfished the modern Mediterranean is, and that you know, it's lovely as it is sitting in a seaside taverna on a Greek island, that we're not getting the same experience that you would have had in antiquity in terms of the breadth of species of fish.
That's true. Although it's nice to see that, in fact, the two most popular Mediterranean fish are still there, right? Yeah. So both the brim and the bass are still the kind of bedrock fish of the Mediterranean seafood. So yes, but you're right. I mean, the overfishing of the Mediterranean is one of the great kind of ecological tragedies,
I think it is. And I think it robs us of a bit of a sense of, as you were talking about, the importance of seafood in a classical context, that we're not necessarily getting that same experience that the bountiful seas would have provided in antiquity.
Absolutely. And it was so important to the diet as well, particularly for things like, for example, making sure that everyone gets enough iodine, for example, you know, famously, right, places that are away from the sea always, particularly in antiquity, even to the pre-modern period, you know, suffered bad cases of goiter, for example, yes. And other kind of diseases associated with iodine deficiencies, with lack of seafood in the diet. Yeah. And the Greeks, would fresh fish, luxury good, but they also salted a lot of fish as well, so that even though it's a luxury good, that's got those smaller salted fish do seem to kind of go down the social scale a bit as well. So,
and of course there's also fish sauce, which you've alluded to before, famously Roman garum, but yes. There were a variety of sauces as well. Could you explain to our listeners how...
Yes, I mean, it's a sauce that's made from the dried remnants of fish.
Left out in the sun.
And yeah, so if you like the idea of fermented dried fish juice, then that's what essentially fish sauce is.
It's a reminder, the human palate does change, both culturally and chronologically.
Although, you know, I mean, when one thinks about kind of the great coordinates, you know, of the kind of different tastes, that they do seem... this umami kind of thing does seem to be with us. But absolutely. So that would have been one of the sort of savoury elements to accompany the seafood. And we have, as you say, that we know that there's a number of sauces. The Greek is taopsa, the kind of the stuff that you add to the fish, and that also would involve chopped herbs and vinegars, that sort of thing as well as the sort of fermented fish sauce.
Do you fish yourself?
I am a late fisherman. So I have come to fishing very late in my life.
Yes.
I had one of those kind of confronting meetings with a doctor who said, "Look, you need to just get out more. You have too sedentary a life. You're sitting at your desk. You need to get out more." So I thought, oh, I hate going outside. So I thought, what am I going to do? So I thought, well, look, what's the most sedentary outdoor pastime I can find? And I thought, fly fishing is the way to go. So I've recently taken up fly fishing, last 3 or 4 years, and love it, absolutely love it. It is the greatest way to go out into nature. You stand still. That's the wonderful thing I love about it.
Yes.
You stand still, you have to stand still, because otherwise you spook the fish, in these gorgeous kind of streams, and it's just so relaxing. No, I love it. I absolutely love it.
I know a lot of people who fish talk about that contemplative nature of that, you know, human and nature. Do you feel that?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think it's because of it's the stillness. I think, and the time as well. That you, it's just you alone.
Yeah.
In the stream.
Yeah.
Surrounded by
you
birds.
Start writing your next book in your head, while you?
Yes, absolutely. And it's lovely. Actually, I just love it. In fact, it's rather irritating when, you know, a fish actually bites your fly. Then you have to spring into action. In fact, it's much, the bit before is actually the best bit.
Now, both of these fish plates are on display currently in the Chow Chak Wing Museum as part of the Wine Dark Sea exhibition on level two. When you see them, I mean, how do you respond to them personally? I mean, you talked about your love of them, but particularly given that you've taken on fishing in the last few years as well, does that give you a whole new appreciation of them?
It does. And I think what you appreciate is really the skill, first of all, in landing a fish. I mean,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
These things doesn't happen by accident, right?
Well, particularly, I mean, yeah, there were no commercial fishing nets in the way that we, you know, the trawlers and so on that have caused the exploitation of fish in the Mediterranean. This was you know, old-fashioned hard work by the fishermen in the ports of Campania and in the ports of Apulia.
Absolutely. And you know, there's a line about, you know, fishing that is that you know, the calories you expend to catch the fish versus the calories you get from eating the fish, you know, often mean that
you're
it's
hungry.
Not worth the effort. So I appreciate the effort. As I say, I think it really speaks to the values of the society very well in terms of, you know, talking about what matters, to them, and it's lovely.
Now, everyone who appears on the podcast, I ask them this question. You know, if you could choose one word as to how these objects signify something for you, what would be the one word you would choose?
Luxury.
Luxury.
Luxury. I think they are luxurious objects. They're pleasure.
Yeah,
they're pleasure on a plate. So I think they're absolutely wonderful.
Well, I think that answer might have actually just answered my final question, but yeah, given that they are on display, when people come into the Chow Chak Wing Museum to view them, or they can view them online through our collection search, what do you want people to think about when they see those plates?
Yeah. Well, I think what I want them to think about is, first of all, the society that produced them, but also I want them to think about their own society as well. You know, what do our food choices tell us about us? You know, what will people be saying about, as it were, our own diet?
Yes.
And diet has now become a really big issue. I'm fascinated by diet. Indeed, one of the things that I've become interested in is, you know, partly through working on Heracles, is the male body and how the male body and particularly the musculature of the male body has changed over time.
Yeah.
And we're living in an extraordinary moment in terms of human diet. So we can now consume protein in a density and quantity that is historically unparalleled.
Yeah. Right?
You go down to the supermarket, you see the protein supplements, you can consume pure protein in a way that no other historical period has ever been able to do it.
Yeah.
And that's changing the nature of our bodies.
Yeah.
And so we're changing our bodies in terms of the way that we can develop our own muscles, and we're producing muscular bodies unlike any...
And of course we're far more sedentary than we used to be as well, which is the... You know,
and that's the flip side, right? So that not only are we more muscular, we're also fatter as well, and as you say, more sedentary. So these two extremes that are coming precisely a product of our diet.
Yeah.
And so I'm fascinated by our contemporary diet and what that does to us. And I think, you know, thinking about food and about diet is a great way, as I say, for getting into the heart of a culture.
It's a bit sobering to think then the way that we stop and admire these fish plates and contemplate the Greek world, perhaps in 1,000 years' time, people will be stopping at a museum to look at a fast food wrapping to consider.
Well, that's right, exactly.
21st century life.
Yeah,
life.
And I think, you know, they won't be as complimentary as we are about the ancient Greeks.
Well, certainly not as beautiful.
Certainly not as beautiful. But I think, you know, again, it was a reminder that actually maybe, you know, one of the most important legacies from the ancient Greeks would be the Mediterranean diet. You know, time and time again, study after study shows it's the diet you should be adopting. Oil, you know, olives, vegetables, you know, a little bit of meat, beans, lentils. That's the kind of stuff you should be focusing on.
While you've been saying that, I've been salivating thinking of the fish taverna at a particular restaurant in Paphos in Cyprus that I'm hoping to get back to next year again. Alistair, thank you so much. This has been brilliant. You know, thank you for joining us on Object Matters for this illuminating discussion.
Well, thank you for the invitation. And it's always lovely to come in and talk about, you know, things in the collection.
And thank you for helping us launch the new exhibition last night as well.
Great fun.
Object Matters is recorded on the grounds of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. The University of Sydney and the Chow Chak Wing Museum pays our respects and acknowledges the traditional custodians of the lands.
Subscribe to Object Matters on your favourite podcast app and connect with the Chow Chak Wing Museum on Instagram, Twitter and Facebook. You can also subscribe to our monthly e-newsletter, News Extra, via our website, sydney.edu.au/museum.